I want to welcome you to the final session of the class on what Socrates knew. Of course, we're really just getting started on knowing what Socrates knew, but I think that the Gorgias is as good an overview as one could possibly want to begin. What I'd like to do is, before I forget for the umpteenth time, well, about actually the fifth, maybe sixth time, I want to pass out this poem that was mentioned way early on by W.B. Yeats called The Choice. The intellect of man is forced to choose perfection of the life or of the work, and if it take the second, must refuse a heavenly mansion raging in the dark. When all that story's finished, what's the news? In luck or out, the toil has left its mark, that old perplexity and empty purse, or the day's vanity, the night's remorse. Originally, it was apropos of the poets, and the question is, is poetry as a kind of autonomous activity good or not? Or does poetry have to subordinate its activity to the good? And Yeats seems to take the latter view, that perfection of the life or of the work is the two choices that we have, and that we are better to pursue perfection of life than of work. In that sense, poetry is not autonomous, and that we should prefer to choose and find more choice-worthy the moral life than the life of art as an end in itself. Which is, of course, interesting from one of the great artists of the century. Now, I am going to start a week from today my next class on the myths of Plato. I hope that many of you, no, in fact, all of you, will sign up and continue our exploration of what Socrates knew. The Myths of Plato deals with two very important dialogues. One is the Timaeus, the other is the Critias. And the two were written as a set. They are really a single work in some ways. And the Timaeus deals with the creation of man and the cosmos, and also begins to describe the great myth of Atlantis, the great story of Atlantis, which is then taken up in the Critias, and then the Critias ends, apparently in mid-sentence, before Zeus pronounces his judgment on the Atlantids. And it's always been very mysterious what happened there. Jay and Finley said that obviously Plato had a stroke and couldn't finish it. I think that's one of the more preposterous things that Finley said. And it ends apparently broken off in mid-sentence, although I think there's every reason to believe that it was supposed to be that way and that it's meaningful, not just a fragment. What we'll do basically is this. We're going to take these two myths, one the account of the origin of the cosmos and man, the other the account of Atlantis, which is a political myth, and we're going to examine all the possible interpretations of the meanings of these two myths, but also we're going to use this as a way of broaching the issue, what is myth, and what is its relationship to philosophy, Plato's philosophy in particular, and the love of wisdom in general, which is, I think, an enormously important question. So what I would like to do is I'd like to get you all involved in this. I think it will be very enjoyable. The first lecture, I'm going to lay out my my account of the framework of the dialogue by talking about the different characters involved. There are four characters: Socrates, Timaeus, Hermocrates, and Critias. And I'm going to talk about each of them, and also about a fourth character, or actually I should say a fifth character, who is mentioned as absent. And the reason why I hung up the Raphael School at Athens painting is that here is Socrates here, okay, with his stub nose and bald head. And here is Plato, and in his hand is a copy of the Timaeus. This is Timaeo on the side of the book. And that didn't really come out in the photocopy I made on the flyer. I should have lightened it up a notch. But Socrates is counting on his fingers. And there's one, two, three, four fingers, including the thumb, that he has extended. And the beginning of the Timaeus is 1, 2, 3. But where, my dear Timaeus, is the fourth of our guests of yesterday, our hosts of today? So this is actually an illustration of the beginning of the Timaeus itself. And there should be three people present. And there are actually more. Well, none of this could be historical because they're all lumped together. But this man, the general, is Hermocrates, who was a great general of Syracuse. And this fellow, this very old guy, might either be Critias or Timaeus himself. I don't know who. Critias was supposedly very old. These other two figures who seem rather old in the background could be Timaeus or Critias too. But anyway, we have a representation of the very, very beginning of this dialogue here. It's just kind of hard to assign exactly who this is. My suspicion is that this has to be Timaeus, because he looks like such an old sage with his odd little hat on. And whoever this young fellow is an open question, although the argument I'm going to make is that the absent fourth person was the handsome Alcibiades. Maybe Raphael had the same interpretation that I do, and this is supposed to be Alcibiades. So anyway, this is a wonderful painting. This is Heraclitus writing his little aphorisms. And I think that this is supposed to be Epicurus, although this fellow here could also be Epicurus. It's Aristotle, right? And he's holding his ethics. And this is why Plato's hand is pointing towards the heavens, because the Timaeus deals with the cosmos, the order of the world whole, the origin of the world whole, whereas the ethics deals with life on earth, and Aristotle has his hand extended sort of flat over the earth as opposed to up towards the heavens. And the two are in nice harmony with one another. And I think that really the implication is that their stances seem rather harmonious, the two together sort of form a whole. The Platonic cosmology and the Aristotelian ethics form a whole. I wish I knew the identities or the intended identities of a lot of these other figures. Clearly they're supposed to represent Greek philosophers. That could very well be women too, although there are a lot of long-haired men.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, so it's hard to tell. But that's clearly a woman. Yeah. And who she's supposed to represent, I don't know. Yeah, anyway, it would be very interesting to know the identities or intended identities of all of these figures. And who knows, maybe there's some source that I could find that would explain all that. Now, what I'd like to do is wrap everything up. And the end of the Gorgias really rises to great rhetorical peaks. Socrates is at his most eloquent and persuasive here. And it's really magnificent. So let's go to page 107. It was sort of hard for me to decide where to leave off, where to break between tonight's session and last week's session. So I'm just going to sort of repeat. I'm going to straddle the divide, actually. At the bottom of page 107, just above where it says 509D, Socrates raises the question about how to avoid doing and suffering injustice. I'll just read. Then of these two, doing injustice and suffering it, we assert that doing injustice is the greater evil, suffering injustice the lesser. By preparing what, then, would a human being help himself so as to have both of these benefits, that of not doing injustice and that of not suffering injustice? Is it a power, he says, or a wish that insulates us, ensures us against doing and suffering injustice? Now, this is an odd claim. What do you mean? What's the distinction between a power and a wish? Well, let's read on. This is how I mean it. If he does not wish to suffer injustice, will he not suffer injustice? Okay. Meaning, is it just a matter of rectifying one's will and not wanting to suffer injustice. Is that all it takes to avoid suffering injustice? Okay. Or if he has prepared a power of not suffering injustice, will he not suffer injustice? But the point is simply this. A wish just refers to one's intention, what one elects to do, right? And is it possible to ensure oneself against suffering injustice simply by electing to do that, making that one's aim? Or does one have to do more than simply want that? Does one have to ensure certain powers on one's behalf to prevent that? Okay. Now, this distinction might not make a whole lot of sense right now until you see the alternative. Okay. Callicles says, this at least is clear. It is if he has prepared power. Callicles believes you have to have power to ensure yourself against suffering injustice. Now, what about doing injustice? If he does not wish to do injustice, is this sufficient, for he will not do injustice? Or against this thing, too, must one prepare a certain power and art? Again, is it enough to simply want not to do injustice? To not do injustice? Or does one need to do more? Does one need to exercise, gather arts, do things like that? That's the question. Okay. A little further on, this is at the very bottom of page 107, the last two lines. Why haven't you answered me in this very thing, Callicles? Were Polus and I, in your opinion, correctly compelled in the earlier speeches to agree? Or were we not, when we agreed that no one does injustice wishing to do so, but all doers of injustice do so involuntarily? Right. So the wishing refers to, right, an act of will, voluntarily, whereas, as opposed to the involuntary. That's one sense in which wish has to be understood as voluntary, as a choice. But the fact is that just by wishing not to do something, we might not be able to avoid it. We might need to back up and strengthen our wishes with arts and power. That's the question he raises. And so the question is, what are the arts, if you will, and the powers one needs in order to avoid doing injustice and to avoid suffering injustice? Now, it strikes me that Socrates believed that it's not sufficient just to wish not to do injustice. Why? Well, because it turns out that all human beings wish the best, right? But that doesn't really count for much given how ignorant we are of what's the best. And so it's necessary not just to mean well in order to avoid doing bad things. It's also necessary to know what's good. Right. And if you don't know what's good, then you're going to do bad things even though you wish to do the good. And so the art, if you will, and the power that one needs to cultivate in order to avoid doing injustice is going to be ultimately philosophy. Because what philosophy is the activity of pursuing knowledge of the good, and to the extent that we know what the good is, then we'll avoid doing bad things. Right? So, in addition to our good intentions, we also need knowledge to direct those good intentions to the proper end. Having good intentions or wishing to do good isn't enough to ensure that we end up, in fact, doing good. Now, the question becomes, at this point, well, what about ensuring ourselves against being victims of injustice? Is it enough simply to wish that we do not become victims of injustice, or do we have to take positive steps in order to make ourselves immune from this? And as it turns out, Socrates says that it's not possible to take positive steps to make ourselves immune from suffering injustice. And he lays out what positive steps someone like Callicles would recommend, and as it turns out, the insurance is worse than the thing that you're trying to avoid. Okay, so let's look at this. This is at the top of 108, below where it says 510A. Socrates says, one must therefore prepare a certain power and art against this too, as it would seem, in order that we not do injustice. Meaning, he's saying we have to have a power and art against doing injustice, certainly. Socrates says, what in the world then is the art for the preparation of suffering no injustice, or as little as possible? Examine if it seems to you what it does to me. For to me it seems to be the following. One must either rule in the city oneself, or even rule as tyrant, or else be a comrade of the existing regime. These are the only ways of ensuring yourself against suffering and injustice, to be a tyrant or their friends. But then the question is, well, Callicles, what is the basis of friendship between two men? Isn't it likeness between them? Like attracts like. So if you're going to become friends with a tyrant, you can't be a better man than the tyrant, because he'll resent you. And you can't be an inferior man, because he'll look down on you and treat you badly. You have to be pretty much like the tyrant. You have to be an equal to them. Okay? And how do you become that way? Well, at the top of 109, he says, of the friend of the tyrant, that is only that man who, being of the same character and praising and blaming the same things, is willing to be ruled and to be submissive to the ruler. This man will have great power in that city. To this man no one will rejoice to do injustice. Isn't this how it is? Right. If you're very like the tyrant, if you praise and blame the same things and you're willing to submit to the tyrant's demands, then you'll enjoy power. And no one will be able to do injustice to you with impunity. And that's the insurance policy, to prevent you from being treated unjustly. He goes on, then if some one of the young in that city thought, in what way might I have great power, and no one might do me an injustice? This, it would seem, is the path for him, immediately from youth, to accustom himself to rejoice and to be distressed at the same things as the master, and to make preparations so to be as much as possible like that man. Isn't it so? We have to start out very young trying to make ourselves as much like the man, right, the guy who's in charge. And he says at the center of the page, will not doing injustice then be accomplished too? Or far from it, if he is like the ruler who is unjust, and if he has great power alongside this man, wholly to the contrary, I think, at any rate, in this way, his preparation will be aimed at being able to do as much injustice as possible and not to pay the just penalty when he does it, won't it? This is how we have to, you know, get in good with the powers that be. And then he sums it up where it says 511a. So then, the greatest evil will befall him when he is degenerate and maimed in his soul through imitation of the master and through power. And now the question is this really worth it? To ensure oneself against being a victim of injustice. The question is, you know, what does it profit you to gain the whole world if you lose your soul? I mean, you could put it that way. And this is exact Socrates' view. Does it profit you to become safe in this world if you have to lose your soul to become safe? And then what he does is he goes on, and he talks about the idea of self-preservation. And he has a rather lofty contempt for self-preservation. And indeed, he thinks that of being too concerned with self-preservation is a sign of slavishness and a lack of nobility. Socrates, at the bottom, well, where it says 511b, he says, I know, good Callicles, unless I'm deaf. He's anticipating Callicles' objections. Since I hear you just now, Polus many times and almost all others in the city, but you now hear from me that he will kill, namely the unjust man, will kill if he wishes, but it will be a base man killing a noble and good man. If you don't take, you know, insurance out against being treated unjustly, you can be killed. But he says, look, you're going to hear it from me now. This isn't such a bad thing, because when this killing takes place, it will be a bad man killing a good man. And Callicles says, isn't this exactly the infuriating thing, that bad men kill good men? And Socrates' response is, not for him who has intelligence, as the argument indicates. Or do you think a human being ought to make preparations for living as long a time as possible and to practice those arts that always save us from dangers, like the one you are bidding me to practice, rhetoric that brings us through safely in the law courts? Callicles says, yes, by Zeus, and I'm counseling you correctly. You should avail yourself of all the arts of self-preservation. What about this, you best of men? Does the science of swimming seem to you to be an august one? No, by Zeus, not to me at any rate. Why is swimming not august? Well, swimmers and, you know, lifeguards and so forth save people who are drowning, right, if you fall into the sea or any other body of fluid. And what about the pilot's art? Don't pilots of ships save people from disaster by avoiding the rocks, right, and steering them safely across the oceans to port? Is that an august art? No. And the pilots don't think it's an august art. You know, they take their obols or their drachmae, you know, in payment, and hey, and just go about their business, right? They don't pride and plume themselves and treat themselves as really special and as being the practitioners of the most august art. And Socrates, at the center of 110, talks about this, and it's really quite nicely put. He says, and the man himself who has the art of piloting ships and has accomplished these things, stepping off alongside the sea in the ship, walks around with a modest bearing. For he knows, I think, how to calculate that it is unclear which ones of those sailing with him he has benefited by not letting them be thrown into the sea, and which ones he has harmed by not letting them be thrown into the sea. Okay. Knowing that he disembarked them no better than what they were like when they embarked in respect to either their bodies or their souls. He therefore calculates thus, if someone possessed by great and incurable sickness of the body has not drowned, this man is wretched not to have died, and has received no benefit from him. If therefore, or it therefore cannot be that, if someone has many incurable sicknesses, and what is held in higher honor than the body, the soul, this man should live, and that he, the pilot, will help him by saving him, either from the sea, or from a law court, or from any other place whatsoever. Rather, he knows that it is not better for the degenerate human being to live, for he must necessarily live badly. So he's saying, look, the arts of self-preservation are not that noble. Why? Because they're indifferent to the question whether or not particular selves should be preserved. And Socrates is very cold here. He's saying, look, some people are better off dying. Right? When the ambulance people come and take somebody away, this is an example that's just sort of ghastly. The grandfather of a friend of mine was in his 80s, and he was senile, and pretty much gone as a person, and he had a heart attack. Right. Now, one would think, okay, you know, it's time for him to go. Right? This is not such a bad thing. We all have to die sometime, and he's way out of it. Well, her mother, who was there when he started having the heart attack, immediately panicked, and it wasn't so much that she didn't think that it would be better for him to go at this point. She just didn't want it to happen in her house. She was very superstitious. She is an extremely superstitious woman. She consults with gypsies on a regular basis. Okay. Anyway, so she called the ambulance, and by the time that the ambulance got there, he was pretty much brain dead from the lack of any oxygen. Right, to the brain, because his heart had stopped. And so from senility he went to brain death, and then he stayed alive in the hospital for a very long time, and basically, you know, consumed every last bit of resource that, you know, the man had. And clearly, one would have to say, look, the art that saved this man's life was not a particularly noble art, because it was completely indifferent to whether or not it would have been better or worse for him to have died at that point. Right? And so simple preservation of life is not necessarily a good thing. It's only a good thing if the life is somehow worth preserving. And Socrates is saying if a person is terminally ill, right, and somebody keeps them alive by preventing them from falling into the ocean or whatever, or preventing them from, you know, having that heart attack, well, it's not necessarily a good thing. The art of self-preservation or life preservation is only a good thing if the life is really worth preserving. And, of course, the people with the ambulance and the doctors don't make that decision, and nor should they, right? It's good that they just sort of, I would feel much safer, and I think it's good that the medical profession pursues zealously the preservation of the lives of patients, but at the same time, it's not necessarily the best thing to do. But maybe that shouldn't be the decision of the paramedic. Okay? I wouldn't want that decision to be put in their hands. Not every life is worth preserving. That's the sense here. Now, I don't think it's prudent to allow somebody else to make those sorts of decisions for people. Right? Certainly people with pecuniary interests in emptying out hospital beds or not paying insurance payments. I mean, that's a prescription for disaster. But the fact is there's some truth to this claim. And Socrates is saying, look, the life at any cost isn't worth living. It's only a good life that's worth living. Okay. That's his argument. And he goes on and talks about engineers and generals and other people who do things that help to long life. And then on the middle of 111, he says, Callicles, you have disdain for these people, these engineers and generals and pilots and lifeguards and so forth, but on what basis do you disdain them? Because really all you're recommending rhetoric as is an art of life-saving. Right? It's indifferent to the question whether life is good or bad. So he says, just above the center of 111, yet on the basis of the things for which you praise your own affairs, by what just argument do you despise the engineer and the others of whom I was just speaking now? I know that you would say you are better and a better ancestry, but if the better is not what I say, but virtue is simply this, saving oneself and one's own property of whatever sort one happens to be, your blame of the engineer, of the doctor, and of all the other arts that have been produced for the sake of saving us becomes ridiculous. But you, blessed man, see if the noble and the good are not something other than saving and being saved. There's a difference between the noble and the good and mere self-preservation. Okay, that's what he's saying. For the true man, at any rate, must reject living any amount of time whatsoever and must not be a lover of life, which is an extraordinary thing to say. Rather, turning over what concerns these things to the God, and believing, the women saying, that no man may escape his destiny, he must investigate what comes after this, in what way he who is going to live for a time live best. That's the issue, right? He's saying, look, there are all kinds of arts to help us prolong our lives. But there's something ignoble about focusing all one's attention simply on the prolongation of life. For one thing, you're never going to win that game. Right? You're never going to make yourself immortal. You might stretch things out longer, but it's not like it's a game that you can win. Ultimately, he says, you should just give these things over to the gods and trust the saying of the women, namely, that no one escapes their own destiny. There's a recognition of the limitations of human striving for control over nature and human techniques for extending life. Okay. Which is true. There are limits. And instead of plunging oneself into the world of contingencies and expediencies and launching oneself on the project of mastering one's own destiny, which really is impossible, one should take a step back from all that, apply oneself to the extent that it's necessary to control one's environment and take care of oneself physically. But one's main focus should be the question of whether one's good, whether one has a good life, however long that life might be, rather than one just has a long life that's somewhat indifferent, morally speaking. And we do have a choice. People who are caught up in self-preservation can put a hell of a lot of time and energy into that. You know, people going to health clubs, taking their antioxidants, you know, working out and so forth. You can spend virtually every waking hour working or preserving your body, right? And the fact of the matter is that that's going to take away time from pursuing something that's in a sense even better or more important, namely assuring the quality of your soul. And why is this thing better? Because, to put it in language that Socrates doesn't use, but we've probably found agreeable, it's more important to be worthy of happiness than to be happy. Or better yet, in this context, it's better to be worthy of living a long life than to live a long life, right? The best thing, of course, would be to have both, right? To have a long life and to be completely worthy of it, a long, rich, full life. But we can't master circumstances enough to ensure that that's going to be the case. Again, we have to leave that to fate, right? So what do we have to do? We have to choose, therefore, the most important goal to pursue. And the most important goal to pursue is worthiness. And that's a goal that we can actually pursue with a much more, put it this way, with greater certainty of success, because it has to do with the quality of our own souls. It requires working on the inner self, right? But that's very close to us, and entirely, or almost entirely, within our control. You know, our character, our thoughts, our actions can be controlled by us to a far greater extent than the state of our bodies, or the state of society, or the behavior of others, and so forth. And so to the extent that we have a choice between pursuing worthiness of having a long life and pursuing a long life, it seems that the best thing to do is to work on the thing that you're more assured of success with. And that's going to be working on the soul. You know, you shouldn't be indifferent to the needs of the body, but at the same time, you can be slavishly concerned with prolonging life, and do so at the cost of really making life worth living. And Socrates is famous for the claim, the unexamined life isn't worth living. What does that mean? It means that the life of a person who is unconcerned with their own soul is not worth living. The person who's indifferent to goodness leads a life that really isn't worth living, because they haven't done anything to assure the worthiness, their own worthiness to live. And Plato doesn't seem to be a believer in the idea that human beings just have an innate worth. Right? If that were true, then all lives would be worthwhile simply by being lives. He really seems to think that the worth of life is something that we have to achieve, that we have to do things to make our lives worth living. And that has everything to do with the cultivation of character, the care of the soul.
Huh? Did you say that was Plato and Socrates?
Well, Plato and Socrates, it's kind of hard to separate the two,
yeah.
Right? But I think there's something profoundly true about this. Again, the ideal world is a world where you don't have to choose between, say, moral worth and happiness as a natural being, you know, good health, nice things, and so on and so forth. That would be the ideal world, but it's not the real world. And what you need to do, therefore, is you need to keep in mind that when you're forced to choose one or the other, you have to choose the one that's most worthy of choice, meaning the best, and as it turns out, the best is also the most practicable in the sense that it's more under your control. Okay? And the best is the care of the soul. So I think there's something very profound about this. Again, he says, rather, turning over what concerns these things, namely the prolongation of life, physical existence, to the God, to the divine, and believing the women's saying that no man may escape his destiny, he must investigate what comes after this. In what way he who is going to live for a time live best. I think there's something wonderful about that. And then he sums up his argument against Callicles. At the very bottom of 111, he says, our choice of this power in the city will be at the cost of the things dearest to us. And if you think that any human being at all will impart to you a certain art, such as to make you have great power in this city, while being unlike the regime, whether for better or worse, as it seems to me, you are not taking counsel correctly, Callicles. He's saying, look, to become powerful in the city is like, you know, he likens it to the witches of Thessaly, who can draw down the moon and exercise power over nature, but at a cost. They lose their sight, or they lose their children, something like that. And he's saying the same thing goes with pursuing power in the city. You can win the world, but you will lose what's most important, namely your soul. And that's not a good deal. And anyone who says you can have your cake and eat it too, that you can become powerful in a city without being like it, is telling you a lie. If you believe that, I've got some swampland, you know, to sell you. Or I'll sell you the Brooklyn Bridge, too. And poor Callicles seems to have bought, intellectually speaking, a Brooklyn Bridge, if he thinks that he can do all this. He goes on, 1, 2, 3, 4 lines down from the top of 112. Okay. For you must be not an imitator, but like these men in your very own nature, if you are to achieve something genuine in friendship with the Athenian people. You can't just act like a friend of the people. You have to be one. You're not going to be able to just pretend and maintain your inner freedom. By pandering to the crowd, you will become like the crowd eventually. You will transform yourself. And yes, by Zeus, with the son of Pyrilampes to boot, he's referring to Alcibiades. So then, whoever will turn you out most like these men will make you skilled in politics and in rhetoric, as you desire to be skilled in politics. For each group of men rejoice at speeches said in accord with their own character, and are annoyed at those of an alien character, unless you say something else, dear head. Which is a kind of strange phrase, dear head. Do we say anything against these things, Callicles? And Callicles doesn't have much to say. And then what Socrates does is he goes on and begins to argue the necessity of private accomplishments before public accomplishments. But just to review what we've looked at so far, Socrates claims that when it comes to preparing yourself not to suffer injustice, that there's really nothing you can do. The only way you can be immune to suffering injustice is to, well, he never mentions this, but you could go live on a desert island, right? You could leave human beings behind. He doesn't seem to want to opt for that. And the second thing you can do is you can become so much like your fellow man that they wouldn't want to do any harm to you. But he says that would only be an option, really, if you were surrounded by good men. Then you wouldn't have to worry about them doing injustice anyway. So obviously, if you're worried about avoiding the injustice of your fellow men, it's because your fellow men are unjust. The only way to get these guys to like you is to be just like them, which is to be unjust too. There is no insurance, therefore, that's worth the price against being treated unjustly by unjust men. Right? Because it's better to suffer injustice than to do it, right? for the reason that it's better to be a good man who suffers than it is to be a bad man. Right? And doing injustice makes you bad. And it's precisely by becoming an unjust man that you can insure yourself against being treated unjustly. But it's not worth the price. Right? It's better to suffer injustice as a just man than to become a bad man in order to avoid suffering injustice. And he goes on, and I think he makes a very good case against that, and also a very good case against the whole notion that self-preservation should be our primary goal. And the fact of the matter is that human beings can be corrupted and turned into slaves. They can be turned into monsters, they can be turned into slaves, if they are primarily concerned with the prolongation of their life. You can be blackmailed into doing anything if you show that you have a sufficient fear of death. And if you fear death more than any other thing. If you fear death more than villainy, there will be people who can turn you into a villain. Right? If you fear being a villain more than being dead, there's no way that somebody can turn you into a villain. Because you'll choose the best, which is death, rather than villainy. So at this point, starting on 113, Socrates says something about, you know, the great statesman of Athens, and he launches into his critique of Pericles and Miletiades and Themistocles and Cimon, and he tries to show that these men were not practitioners of true statesmanship because they made the people worse rather than better. Yes, they did choke the city with tribute and wealth, with walls and docks. They built fleets. They made it powerful and wealthy, but they also made it rotten. And he says, no one would say that a horse trainer or an ass trainer is a good horse or ass trainer if the animals come to them gentle and tractable and leave them stubborn and constantly nipping at one another and at the people who are supposed to be their masters. No one would say that a person was successful. But that's exactly what happened with Pericles. He ruled for a very long time, but he was overthrown by his own people eventually because of the basest and most petty of motives. He didn't make them better, he made them worse. And so is the claim of all the other great statesmen of Athens' peak. They left the people worse than they were before. And the clearest example of that is that all of these people saw the people turn against them at the end of their political careers. And if that's not a sign of failure, I don't know what else is. You know, no one would be claimed a good dog trainer if they got a dog and by the time they were done, the dog was biting them. You know, you take a gentle puppy and turn it into a bloodthirsty cur, that's not the sign of a good trainer. But it's very interesting, on 113, about 10 lines down, Socrates says, Then if Callicles, intending to act publicly in political affairs, we urged each other on to building, to the greatest buildings, whether walls or dockyards or sacred temples, would we have to examine ourselves and inquire first whether if we know the art or do not know it, that is, the art of building, and from whom we learned it, would we have to do this or not? You say, look, if you were to get up in front of the people and urge them to build some new buildings, wouldn't you first have to know yourself, he says, and know whether you know the art of building and who you learned it from? Because if you don't know this art, right, and you don't know where you got your ideas about this, then you're not qualified to teach. And he goes on and says, what if a person were to say to you, well, you know, Callicles, have you ever built anything privately? You're proposing to build on a grand scale publicly. So what have you built privately? Have you built anything? Have you done anything in your private life that would seem to qualify you to advise the public on building affairs? And the answer, of course, is no. He's done nothing like that. Well, isn't that preposterous and absurd? And then he goes on to page 114, where it says 515a. He moves to the political example, right? Socrates says, now then, Callicles, you best of men, since you are yourself just now beginning to do the city's business and urge me on and reproach me for not doing it, shall we not examine each other? Well then, has Callicles yet made any one of the citizens better? Is there someone who was base before, unjust, intemperate, and foolish, who has become noble and good because of Callicles, whether foreigner or townsman, slave or free? Tell me, if someone questions you closely about these things, Callicles, what will you say? What human being will you say you have made better through intercourse with you? Or do you shrink from answering, if indeed there is some work of yours, while you are still a private man, before you put your hand to public practice? It's a great question. It relates to the question about ruling yourself versus ruling others. You want to rule others. Okay, well, have you ruled yourself first? You say you can improve other people. Okay, well, have you improved yourself or any person in the private sphere of your life? Is there anybody you can list who's become a better human being through interacting with you? If not, what qualifies you to step into the role of a leader and try and improve people on a grand scale? It's appalling how many politicians, right, claim that they will do good for the society, but if you look at themselves or at the people around them, you don't find examples of human excellence. In fact, you find crooks and scoundrels, right? If a person manages, either by corrupting the people around him or simply by choosing badly, to be always surrounded by crooks and scoundrels, then how can they claim to make others better in the political realm? You have to look at the individual and you have to look at their friends and their interactions first before they can be seen as worthy of engaging in political life. Jung never really amounted to much as a psychologist or a psychological theorist until he went crazy. Then he put himself back together and suddenly he became enormously innovative.
Yeah.
A lot of people who go through troubles and get out of it are far better at giving advice to people who are troubled than somebody who's just sort of stolidly healthy, and okay, and have never really gone through any crises in life, right? Socrates makes the point at one point, isn't a physician who's been sick, really sick, in some sense, much better at being a physician because they've lived it and they experienced it from the inside than somebody who's always just been in the pink of health, right? And there's some truth to that. So, I mean, in a way, if he's got problems, it can be an advantage, but only if he confronts them and gets to the other side, right?
Exactly.
I'm something of a misanthrope. I was so impressed, I think it was in Hannah and Her Sisters, Max von Sydow makes a statement, people are always going on about the Holocaust and how unimaginable it is, but he says, given human nature, the only thing that shocks me is that there aren't more of these things. And I sort of have to agree, I'm somewhat pessimistic about human beings, and because I'm so pessimistic about human behavior, I tend to be sentimental about animals, right? The fact is that dog eat dog doesn't apply to dogs, it only applies to humans.
It depends on the dogs. I mean, wild dogs are not very...
When cats torment mice, it's not that they can sympathize with the mouse and therefore take pleasure in the torment. Whereas when human beings torture other human beings, it's precisely on the basis of the fact that they can project themselves into that person's suffering and enjoy it. So human beings are capable of far greater evil than animals. Well, the fact is that our capacity to sympathize with other human beings does make it possible for us to be kind, but it also makes it possible for human beings to be far crueler than any other species known.